Hello, this is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki Balancing Form and Essence. This month, we're into service. And this has come out of many interviews that I had over January and February about the themes love, compassion, and then gratitude. I really appreciate the interviews that I did the first 2 months of this year because they really took me deeply into the practice of Reiki, into a lot of my lessons that I learned for myself. You know, I'm one of these people that do a lot of things at one time, or I used to anyway, before 2 years ago. And, you know, I always had something going on, and I wouldn't actually call it service, although some people might call it service, because I always felt like it had to do with me, that there was some thing that I got out of it. It was something that I wanted to do for someone because I loved them, or because I wanted to care for them, and I did care for them. Or it was something that I felt like needed to be done, and I was the person to do it. But there's something about service, when we speak of it in a spiritual sense, that I feel is, it's very thought-provoking, because lots of times people end up, putting on the word selfless service. And I feel like this is redundant, because for me, that's what service is about, is to serve and to be with people in a way that is totally giving of yourself without any holdbacks and without any need for compensation, acknowledgement, or even self patting on the back. I don't know what that is. I've forgotten the word. So, and I feel that, in Reiki, sometimes we find ourselves doing these kinds of services. Just as we look back, we think, oh, maybe that was service. Or we think back and go, well, that was an example of service, and it felt really good. Today I have with me Deborah Rodney. She's a Reiki master. And when I met her, lived in Portland, Oregon. Now she has had a life in the Caribbean, where she's going, where she is now, and where I'm talking to her from. And she's more in the States again these days, and I was able to have contact with her again. And I've always felt like Deborah was on the edge of service, in the sense where she was doing these creative things like playwriting and scripts and books and theater and so on, and they always seem to be for what we might call a good cause. And I never really could figure out what she was doing. So when I thought about service, I thought about Deborah for some reason, and so I called her, and now we're able to talk with each other over Skype and do this interview. So now we're all going to find out what Deborah does. So Deborah, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And tell me, where in the Caribbean are you right now?
I'm in a little country called St. Vincent and the Grenadines. It's about 32 little islands, and I'm writing and directing a television program on tourism.
Uh-huh.
So I get to fly around in little airplanes and go in boats, and it's a dream job, but it's actually a lot of work because I film about 50 different locations, and put together a program that runs 24 hours a day round the clock that shows people what to see and what to do in St. Vincent and the Grenadines while they're here on vacation.
Well, that's amazing. I didn't realize St. Vincent was like a whole string of islands.
Yeah, it actually is, but there's a lot of them are uninhabited. There's about 7 islands that have people living on them. Some islands have about 200 people, and some are, you know, bigger that have about the biggest island has about 90,000 people.
Oh, wow. Well, I had a friend of mine who used to live on St. Vincent. I know.
Really?
I don't know really where. And, she was there for a hurricane. I think this must have been in the early 80s. And she said it was the most horrifying experience of her life, and she never wanted to live there you know, again, so she moved. But,
well, for, you know, 4 or 5 months, it's actually a possibility every year. The hurricane can come through unexpectedly. One was just here last year, slipped between two islands, did a little bit of damage. We haven't had any bananas this year because the banana trees were all blown down.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's amazing. A tropical island without bananas. That's hard to fathom.
It was a shock to me too when I got here.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, back to Reiki. So,
okay.
Can you share with us how you met Reiki and a little bit about your Reiki path? That would be really interesting.
Okay. Well, I was actually in a very difficult time in my life, and I was living in Guyana, which is in South America, and life just really didn't have very much meaning for me, and I was pretty much a lost soul. And during my travels, I lived in the jungle in South America, where I was in a sort of life and death situation several different times. And one particular time, I was on a river and it was dark and we were running out of gas and the engine was not in very good shape. And I was afraid that we were going to be stranded, you know, in the middle of nowhere. No one would know where I was in the world. And I wouldn't know which bend around the river was, like the camp that I was trying to get to. And the night was so beautiful. And I remember just asking something, some entity, some spirit, you know, of that particular beauty, you know, to give me some guidance, to help me to not be fearful and to find my way, you know, in my life. And that had a profound effect on me. So from that sort of moment on, oh, by the way, we were on about 20 miles of river and we ran out of gas right before we got to our camp. So we coasted in. So that added to this whole awe-struck feeling that I had about, well, wow, maybe someone heard me, maybe something heard me. So it was a very powerful moment. So I, from that moment on, I was really searching. So I read some books and I ended up going back to Portland, and I thought, well, I don't really want to have anybody tell me what spirit is or what spirituality is or what the meaning of my life is. I want to figure that out for myself, having been quite a free spirit through my lifetime. And I felt that I wanted to meditate. So I just saw this ad in a newspaper for a meditation class, and I signed up for it. And it happened to be Sheila King, who's become my very dear friend and is my Reiki master. It was her meditation class. And at that time, neither one of us knew anything about Reiki. But every week for a year, we met with a group of people, and we practiced different techniques of meditation, and different people came in and out of that class. And one day, somebody came with this wonderful thing called Reiki. And we all got excited about it, and I got a Reiki treatment, and it was incredible for me and very wonderful. And I knew from that moment that I wanted to learn Reiki, so I took Reiki from Phil Morgan, Reiki 1, and then a year or so later, I took Reiki 2, and wow, you know, it just became a part of my life. And then a few years later, I wanted to become a master. So I say that Reiki is my spiritual practice and love is my spiritual discipline.
Mm-hmm.
And it has served me well.
Uh-huh. Great. Well, that's beautiful. Can you give us an idea of what year you were in this jungle in Ghana?
Let's see. That would have been about 1984.
Oh, wow.
And I came back to the States in 1986.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Well, that's a really amazing story. I'm just wondering, how did you get to Guyana?
Oh boy, that's a long story too. I had a friend who was had just inherited $1 million, and she wanted to study gemology, and she knew that there was gold and diamonds in Guyana, and she wanted to go and see, you know, check out the diamonds and the gems, precious gems in Guyana. So she just called me up one day and asked me if I wanted to go with her. So I of course said sure. So I dropped everything and we ended up in Guyana, and then I met my daughter's father there and ended up staying there for about 4 years.
Wow. And can you tell me where Guyana is, just for geographically challenged people?
Okay, it's in South America, between near Brazil, Venezuela, and Suriname. So it's one of those three little countries at the top of South America.
Great. And is that how you got connected with the Caribbean, or?
Yeah, actually, I worked, when I was there, I worked for an advertising agency and wrote and produced some of Guyana's very first television commercials, because at the time, the president of Guyana was a socialist-leaning man, and it was okay to steal the signal from New Jersey and broadcast it over big satellite dishes in the country because there was no television stations, but it wasn't okay to show the American commercials because everybody wanted to eat the food and buy the cars and get out of the country. So he made this rule that the cable companies that were stealing the signal had to replace those commercials with local commercials. And I had a little experience in video, so I was hired by a local advertising agency to write commercials that would then be blanked out over the American commercials. And in fact, one of my commercials was played during one year's Super Bowl, which, you know, those commercials run about, I mean, they cost about $1 million for 30 seconds. Right. So I always joke that my commercials were played during the Super Bowl. Well, in Guyana.
That's great. That's great. So, when I talked with you about service and so on, you had some connections. But I'm just wondering, back to your Reiki story before we get to that. So you decided to be a master, and I'm just wondering, what was your motivation to do that, and what year, and sort of what was going on in your life at that point?
It was 1992 when I became a master. And I really, I can't say, you know, it felt like a real calling for me. Although at the time I really didn't know to what level I wanted to be, you know, a teacher. That was a question, has been a question until fairly recently for me. What is my role as a master and in terms of being a teacher? I knew that I wanted to go deeper with Reiki. I wanted to make it is my practice. I don't, it's the only of all the bag of tricks out there to do, Reiki is my practice. And I am very dedicated to Reiki, and I have been since I was initiated. But the question of teaching was always one that was problematic for me, because I was doing very creative things, you know, playwriting, writing. I had a company where I took my plays into the schools, as you graciously introduced me in that respect. Thank you. But I, you know, that was also part of my calling. I mean, I wanted to speak about the environment. I wanted to speak out about bully prevention. I wanted to use the Reiki and the power of Reiki to, you know, kind of grease the skids or add to my, you know, to the power behind my work as an environmental teacher, or my plays were performed in schools for quite a number of years, hundreds of schools throughout Oregon and Washington. I'm trying to, you know, teaching children how to be better environmental stewards and how to make their school bully-free zones. And so there was always a question. Now I'm not so concerned with identifying myself as a writer. Even though I do write and I still take on projects, but I'm really shifting more into what my mastery might look like and what service to Reiki means for me.
You mentioned something that I want to be clear for our listeners. When you talk about bullying, can you just identify that?
Yes, bullying is when someone with greater power tries to control or power over someone with lesser power. And in schools, bullying is a major, is a major problem. You know, bigger kids are bullying younger kids. Girls are bullying other girls over what kind of clothes they wear, what kind of shoes they have. So it's a major issue in the schools. And, you know, some school violence has been identified as being, perpetuated by bullying. Is that clear?
Yeah. Whenever I hear about this, which I do very often, I'm always astonished, and my mind goes, well, how did that get to be such an everyday occurrence?
Yeah, it's pretty disturbing, actually. But the school, you know, the schoolyard is the place where children really learn to compete with each other and to, you know, to create, to develop their turf, you know, to stake it out. and steal other kids' lunch money and whatever else, you know, happens. Bullying starts very young. And that's why I got a commission to do a play, through the, University of Oregon's Center on Violence and Destructive Behavior, because they saw that bullying really begins really young. And then, you know, it doesn't really stop. And the victims of bullying, you know, they carry that with them for, you know, maybe their whole lives sometimes.
And what were some of your things in your shows that could prevent it? Or what would you say, minimize it or explore it with kids? Mm-hmm. Or, I mean, I'm not quite sure how you would approach that.
Okay, well, my show was called Bully the Kid, and it was a wild, wild West American tale. And so there was a big, bad bully that was coming to town and wanted to take over. And the sheriff, didn't use guns, and they were trying to figure out how they were gonna deal with this big, bad bully. And so, you know, essentially they figure out ways to deal with them. Like they stick together. They learn to stick together. They learn to tell, you know, to the difference between telling when somebody's in danger and tattling when you want to get your own way. Uh-huh. And they learn to sing a song of, they learn from the birds how to sing a song of warning, so that when bullying happens, they have some skills to know how to articulate what is going on and who to tell and who it's safe to tell. Uh-huh. And so the school, you know, so it was a program to help the schools be actually bully-free zones. And so it was accompanied by other information that the schools would have to help their teachers identify bullies and help the students be able to protect themselves against bullies.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Oh, interesting. I wonder, do you know if any, I'm sorry to get off on this, but I'm just curious, do you know if any other countries are actually doing anything about this, or do they have this issue?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I can see the issues here, but it's bully prevention is not even on the radar here, for example, in this little Caribbean island. I mean, bullying happens all the time. But again, the United States often sees the issues and tries to find creative ways to deal with them. And I'm sure other places do too, but you know, bullying is a major issue, and I think it should be, have a lot more attention paid to it than it does.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
I mean, especially when we're finding, you know, that in the news, you know, that some of the school shootings and some of the beatings of, you know, gay students have been tied to bullying. And, you know, so there's been some attention paid to it because it's been in the news.
Right. Well, this opens up our question about service. So how do you see service just as a general concept?
Well, that's really shifted for me over the last few years, actually. I felt before that my service was, you know, to teach children about, you know, things that would help to enhance their lives and the world. And, I saw myself, you know, as someone who could have some influence there by, you know, through my plays and through my artistic work. And like you said in the introduction, you know, that's really shifting for me now. Now I don't have an attachment to whether people learn or change as a result of the service that I, you know, that I don't know what the word is, give, maybe the service that I, the time that I spend in service. I know that when I was, initiated into second degree, I happened to be doing one of my plays in a children's hospital. And I remember just sitting there while these children hooked up to all these different tubes and some with shaved heads and some very sick that barely made it into the little arena where we were performing a play. You know, I remember just sitting there and throughout the whole play, just sending distance to the children without any, you know, without any expectation or any, not, no one even knew I was doing it, but it just felt right. It felt like what I was supposed to be doing in that moment. And that's more how I feel, now, you know, I feel like I can provide, can send Reiki, can send what love, you know, can offer something without any expectations about getting anything, you know, anything back, including that patting yourself on the back sort of, mentality about service. I mean, I think we can do service in the world, and it's so important right now, without any expectations. But that's a process. That's a discipline. You know, that's a practice. It just doesn't come natural. We always sort of look for, oh, good, I'm doing good right now, or, oh, I'm going to get something from this in some way. My karma is going to be better, whatever it is.
Uh-huh. And what do you feel your process was in getting to this place? And if Reiki had anything to do with that?
Well, I definitely think Reiki had a lot to do with that. I mean, I think that, you know, when we tap into the Reiki energy, when we send distance, and when I do Reiki, I am in service. I don't feel like my ego and my personality step aside. And that's been really good. I mean, I was taught that way very strongly, and I've practiced that way. And so it isn't a great leap to go from that, being an antenna for Reiki and not really being the healer, allowing the healing to happen, you know, through the Reiki itself, you know, leads me to this place where there's no great leap to understand that I'm not, my ego is not in the process of people's processes, people's healings.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows me to be able to get, you know, to give more without expectations. But again, it's a practice.
Right. Well, I was just going to say that might have been easy for you, but I'm not quite sure if it's easy for everyone. So I'm just like, that's where my mind went. And so I just wonder, I go back to this piece that my grandmother used to say about getting exchange for Reiki treatments and exchange for, you know, teaching and so on. And, her favorite phrase was, don't make beggars out of people. And I'm just wondering, there's this very interesting dynamic between, that, which I see that some people do, and that it prevents people from actually asking for Reiki because they want to give something in return and they're not allowed to.
Mm-hmm.
And actually it's somehow a lot of this is, quite often this is subconscious. So it's not something that's actually spoken about because people don't realize that this is the process they're in.
Right.
To a place of true service where I feel like both the person receiving and giving are on the same wavelength. So I'm fascinated by this because I don't have any pat answers for it, and I'm don't expect you to have any, but I'm just wondering if you have anything to say about that.
Well, I just recently in December I celebrated my the month of my initiation as a master, and I decided that I would spend that month in service. So every Wednesday I gave free Reiki treatments to people, not just like randomly like I advertised free Reiki, but anyone that I kind of came in contact with that I felt you know, that there would be an openness to receiving. And so I ended up giving quite a few free Reiki treatments, and I was amazed to, you know, to really I was gifted every time. I mean, that's just how it worked. You know, someone would give me, you know, a box of oranges, or somebody would give me a bundle of herbs, or somebody said something that made something, made a difference in something I was thinking about, or someone referred a Reiki student to me, or inevitably there was something happened that was part of that exchange, even though at that moment I was in service as in gratitude for my anniversary of doing Reiki. And I found that was really interesting because it is part of that dynamic of being worthy to receive, and it came in unexpected ways.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, for me, that was, I don't know, that was just magical. And I don't think it always happens that way. Definitely that was my month of doing, you know, free treatments, but that's not, I mean, in general, it's pretty clear that there's an exchange. Uh-huh. And then also there's the question of, I feel like I receive Reiki when it comes through me, when I'm giving Reiki. So what does that mean, you know, in terms of Reiki serving me while I'm serving someone else?
Yeah, so can you address your own question?
Well, you know, sometimes I guess, you know, to be honest, sometimes I feel like I get the best deal. I get some money or I get a box of oranges and I get the Reiki. You know, so, you know, so Reiki serves in, you know, it serves in so many ways. But it isn't one, it isn't ever one way. I mean, I do get when I give, we all do. And we get the benefit of learning from Reiki every time we give Reiki. You know, so, so there's something about this reciprocity. Is that how you say that word? I forget how you say it.
I think not, but I can't remember.
Reciprocal. It's a reciprocal giving in. Yeah. Giving and receiving at the same time, this sort of circular thing.
Right, right. Well, you know, I've always felt like that was a really amazing built-in process and lesson for us all, that when we treat ourselves, that we are both the receiver and the giver. And there aren't very many other instances in our lives where we can say that clearly, and we can experience it clearly. And that must have a profound effect on our psychological, emotional, physical understanding of this balance of the giving and receiving cycle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's it's an incredible teacher, you know, that just that aspect of Reiki, you know. And I feel like when I give Reiki to myself, I am in service to myself, which we often forget. You know, we forget that sometimes we have to love ourselves. You know, we have to, you know, like in the airplane, you know, you have to pull the mask down and put it on yourself before you assist others. You know, I mean, I feel like that's part of being in service to ourselves, and honor that service to ourselves. Or, you know, substitute the word love. You know, we have to love ourselves before we can love others. You know, it sort of fits. And that's what I feel like when I'm giving myself Reiki, you know, I am honoring that giving to myself, which we don't do that enough, I don't think. Interculture doesn't teach us to honor ourselves. We, you know, we tend to compare and contrast, and, you know, our minds click away about all the things that we're not, that other people are. But in reality, this self-love is really crucial. And Reiki gives us this doorway to practice that.
So this brings me back to something that you said when you became a master, that Reiki is your path and love is your...
Yes, Reiki.
Reiki is
my spiritual practice, and love is my spiritual discipline.
Ah, so talk a little bit about that for me.
Okay, well, I feel like Reiki is what takes me to love, what reminds me about love, which teaches me about love. And so I practice Reiki as my practice and my spiritual discipline, how I am attempting, you know, not always succeeding, of course, who does, but my intention is to practice love, you know, and out of that conscious practice, which you put your hands on yourself, that's very tangible, or you put your hands on others, that's a very tangible practice. But the practice of love, you know, is in every moment. You know, what does love look like, you know, when I'm angry at somebody for cutting me off in traffic, or, you know, whatever. What does love look like when, you know, when I feel, you know, disrespected, or, you know, and what does love look like when I'm, you know, when I just want to give without any recognition of getting love back? Or what does love look like, you know, those are the questions that I'm asking. What would love do in this situation? So, you know, when I see someone, for example, begging on the street, is love giving them money, or is love giving them a distance Reiki treatment? Or what does love look like in that situation? Because when I give a beggar money, I actually am seeing myself in a superior position to them. I can give you money because you are too poor to get money for yourself, or lacking, or whatever. That doesn't look like love to me. So there's always a stream of questions about, well, what does it mean? What does practicing love in the world really look like? You know, from moment to moment, day to day, when I'm in the groove of, you know, thinking that and being conscious of that. And of course, you know, time goes by where I forget all of my good intentions, as it all does for everybody. But that's what I am trying to, you know, what I'm trying to practice out of Reiki, out of what Reiki has taught me. Because for me, the energy of Reiki is, you know, is the energy of love.
Mm-hmm. Well, your what you just said reminds me of a program that I think was on the air in January, and it was about compassion or love. I can't remember, but it was somebody was talking about their practice, which came from Reiki, I think, of taking a certain amount of money, and it wasn't like a set amount of money. It was just like, a few dollars, always having a few dollars in their car in dollar bills. And then when they pulled up to street stoplights or something, and there was somebody there with a sign or wanting to gather money for eating or whatever, they would just roll down the window and give them a dollar and say, you know, here, this is for you for today. And for them, it was a way of showing compassion, but also sharing what she had. Mm-hmm. And she didn't feel like she was rich at any moment, but she said, I feel like it's important for me to share what I have, even though what I have is mostly, I feel like, is not enough. Mm-hmm. So it was an interesting play. It really touched me, and I wish that I could splice what she said into this, but I can't. So that's how it is.
Well, I did some work with a group of homeless people. I was commissioned by an arts organization to work with them to create a play about their situation. Oh. And one of the things that I learned, and I actually wrote a play about being homeless in America. And but one of the things that struck me is what people wanted more than the dollar was, you know, a real acknowledgement, you know, a real look into their eyes, a real, you know, an understanding of what their situation was. And and when I premiered my play, I did a reading of the play and I performed it for a bunch of homeless people. And, people came up and cried at the end, you know, because someone had finally, you know, tried to articulate their situation or understand who they were. So, you know, I think giving people a dollar is really important, and I think it really helps, and that's why they're standing there, because they need a dollar for some food or some, you know, milk for their children or whatever. But I also think just the understanding, the true look eye to eye, you know, because a lot of people don't look at homeless people. Right. So, I mean, so there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of room for service. It doesn't just look like a dollar. It looks, you know, it looks like other things too.
Uh-huh. That's really a good point. So, there have been a few really good movies, I feel like, that have had homeless people in them, that have been really thought provoking, because it seems that, often it feels like from the outside, and I don't know how it is from the inside, maybe you have some input into this, but sometimes I feel like the homeless and what we call the homeless are people who don't have a home here in the United States, who live on the streets, and in their own community, some of them actually live really well. And I wonder, am I arrogant, or do I need the safety of my home where I can lock my doors or whatever my thing is, and feel safe, and this is how I want to live? But is there a choice that some people make to live without a home?
Well, when I was working with the people, I worked with them in a community called Dignity Village, and they're a group of, it's actually in Portland, Oregon, and it has, they've built the city gave them, they protested so long that the city gave these homeless people a place. It's blacktop. It's right next to a prison and a compost facility. And it's on the end of the runway. So the planes, like, I mean, it's a worthless piece of real estate, but they gave it to these people and they created a community there. And it's very transient. People come and go into that, in and out of that community. But people, actually there was sometimes I felt being there that there was, they had something that I didn't, which was that they had a real viable sense of community. And the recognition of each other on the streets and knowing what each other goes through and, you know, is going through. And, you know, men sometimes who protect women who are on the streets. And there is a code, you know, if you have, they call them cigarettes that they pick up off the streets. They call them rollies. And if you have two rollies, you share it with your, you know, with another homeless person. So there's this real sense of community and care that sometimes when we pull into our driveway and we go and pull down the garage door and we walk into our house, our lovely houses, but we don't always have that sense of community. So I'm not sure if that's what you were speaking of, but that's something that I felt about, you know, about some homeless people that I met. You know, there was something that they experienced as a community. And there were people there, mostly younger men who did not want to participate in the society and culture and the work world, who choose that lifestyle, the vagabond lifestyle, what's that movie? Into the Wild, you know, that kind of, being untethered. It's easier for a man, obviously, because they're safer being out on the streets, but they would, you know, they chose that. They would go to a city and hang out with other homeless people and find ways to be of service and then move on to the next city and be of service. And in return for being of service, they would get meals and, you know, donations of food and, you know, whatever. They would survive. And I don't know if you know this woman named Peace Pilgrim. She lived a few years ago, about 20 years ago, I guess, now in the States. And she gave up her house and her identity and everything. And she took off to try to teach people about peace. And she didn't go very far without having a meal or a place to sleep because she was being, you know, she's being in service. And that reciprocity or whatever, you know, that give and take happened sort of organically for her in her life experience. I've read a lot about her. In fact, I wrote a little play about her as well. But, you know, so there are people who are making that choice. And of course, there are people who suddenly find themselves homeless who never expected to be there. And they're definitely in shock. Uh-huh. And they, you know, they don't know how the world tilted on them like it did.
Uh-huh. Well, that's very rampant now in the United States, I understand, from all the foreclosures and the economic downturn that has happened, and people have found themselves without a home.
Yeah, it's a pretty bad situation, actually. But I think that in the long run, I'm hoping that it will instill that spirit I talked about before, about sharing your cigarette butts with the other person, you know, or whatever it is that you have that you can share. I mean, I think that human resilience and, you know, we will learn more about service in the years to come. That's my feeling.
Yes, my feeling too. Well, what has been very interesting, and this may be a total giant leap, is that in all the countries of the world, India is probably known for its beggars, its what we call homeless, the great masses of people who are untouchable, or they used to be called untouchables. And these people, and that's, in some way, that's what India was known for, anyway, in my culture from in growing up in the 1950s and 60s. And yet it's from that culture where spiritual service comes from. And mm-hmm. I just am fascinated by this because there is a kind of code, I understand, or an understanding in India that you always share, mm-hmm. no matter what you have. So you always share a certain amount to, you know, your neighbor or the person next door or whatever. And for me, I find that to be so interesting. I mean, it's hard to get my head around it. And I think in just because of that, it allows me to really think more deeply about service, about status, and about who we how we're developing as a society and what my place is in that society.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, I mean, those are all really questions to grapple with. I think that we, you know, we as a culture, we don't tend, I mean, I'm speaking of the American culture. I mean, I think it's a little bit different here in the Caribbean where poverty is rampant. I mean, I see people here sharing, you know, and in general, people in the United States tend to live in their suburbs and, you know, they don't really share their gardens or, I mean, there's certainly a movement of community gardens and other things that are happening right alongside what I'm saying. But in general, we don't, you know, we don't know what service looks like. We know what, you know, trying to get ahead looks like. We know what, you know, our own sense of survival at our economic level that feels comfortable to us, what that looks like. And when we see a homeless person on the side of the road, you know, we have a choice right in that moment to explore what service looks like or not. Mm-hmm. And that's just how it is. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, the more people, I mean, in the Depression, people were helping each other out, certainly in the United States and during World War II, the kitchen gardens and, you know, in England and the European countries, I mean, people were sharing and trying to get along in their communities in ways, you know, out of necessity. And, you know, that's hopeful. It means we can get there. We can learn and understand more what service looks like. Uh-huh. And unfortunately, I don't hope it doesn't, you know, isn't get down, you know, down to, you know, life being difficult makes us do that. I mean, I think we should be practicing that every day.
Well, and isn't that part of the message of Reiki? I'm just wondering from your own experience it's just amazing and wonderful, these specific populations that you've been able to connect with and to write plays for. And, you know, I don't know if you have gotten paid for these through grants or whatever, but it just seems like that's a really wonderful service to these people, to be their voice.
Yeah, my work with the homeless was really an incredible experience. And yeah, I got paid just a little bit, a little stipend, but it was, you know, I feel like I learned more. Again, you know, money's not the only exchange. And so what I learned working with them was a wealth of experience. I mean, for one thing, I got validation for the play that I wrote, because if the play that I wrote wasn't well connected to the people that it was written about or written, you know, with them in mind, I mean, the play, I was prepared to, you know, to throw the play away. And so their feedback to me was really valuable. And also they taught me a lot about my stereotypes about the homeless and, you know, and what really is, you know, what really they want. And part of what they want is to be acknowledged and heard and, you know, they need a voice.
Uh-huh. And that feels like true for all of us.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, it's
definitely. We just want to be heard.
We just want to be heard. So somehow you're, you know, you put yourself into a place of being a vehicle for people to be heard.
Well, thank you for that. I mean, that is my intention, and I think that comes through. You know, the Reiki has also been the teacher there as well. I mean, I came to my mastery really confused, as I said before, about what my role was as a teacher. But uh-huh. my teaching wasn't necessarily manifested as me me to lots of students. Maybe my path is more using the Reiki to inspire my art, you know, to help me connect, you know, because the connection to the homeless people that I worked with, for example, came through a very interesting and what I call a coinky dink, you know, it came through very coincidental means, which I attribute to the energy of Reiki.
Uh-huh. Right. And you've also done, programs for HIV and other things also, I understand.
Yes, I've written documentaries in the Caribbean, which is, the Caribbean is second in the rate of infection next to sub-Saharan Africa. So the issue, HIV is a major issue here in the Caribbean. And so I worked for the government here for a while creating television commercials and documentaries on HIV AIDS. Uh-huh. So again, you know, that was, you know, the question was, well, do I be a Reiki master teacher, or do I, you know, follow my path and do what seems to be, you know, being put right in front of me? And my choice has been to use Reiki to guide me in what's been put in front of me.
Well, then one has to ask the question, do you feel that in taking the responsibility and the step to Reiki mastery, that that's also a step into service?
Ah, yes, I do. I think that's the, you know, that to me is the covenant. You know, I think that's what we are when we step into that initiation. I think that's what we are doing. And I always read your last little page in the blue book to my students that I initiate, which is that they have, let's see, what does it exactly say? I have it right here. But a master, a person committed to service through Reiki, has shared with you a gift. That's a quote from you, by the way, in the blue book. And I, you know, that every time I read it, I'm struck by that. You know, I think that that's what we are committed to, what we are committing to. And for me, that's the overarching covenant that covenant may be a weird word for people, but that's what I feel. It's the overarching covenant or the overarching intention that we take on when we become Reiki masters.
Right. Well, I think covenant is a wonderful word because, you know, covenant, in English, for those of us who aren't really familiar with that, comes through a spiritual connection of an agreement, a sacred agreement. Mm-hmm. And that's how I would define it. And I think that that's true, but it's not often spoken.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that your service has come out in a very interesting way. And it's so important, I think, for people to understand that sometimes teaching is not the vehicle, but there is a teaching component to you, all of what you do.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think there's a linear thing that we get stuck in our modern world, where we're Reiki masters, so we're supposed to teach Reiki. But what if our teaching is Reiki, but under another cover somehow? Mm-hmm.
Right. And I mean, over the years, I've certainly grappled with those questions, you know, and I think I'm coming full circle again. You know, I mean, I think that my teaching work in the world, is shifting, you know, as I've turned 60 and I'm regrouping and reevaluating my purpose in this particular year. And I, you know, I'm sort of feeling like I'm heading towards, back to Reiki as my service and teaching more. So it's interesting. It's the ebb and flow thing we were talking about before we went on the program, you know?
Right.
I've kind of gone out into the world and now I feel like I'm on this, maybe on this movement back in. The breath is coming back in again to being this personal connections with people.
Uh-huh.
But we'll see, you know, we'll see.
Well, I'm just curious if you can share with me what leads you to that thought.
Well, you know, I think that, it just seems to be what's happening. I can't really articulate it too well, except that that's what I feel inside. You know, that's when I look at the world and I look at the chaos and I look at, you know, filming for 21 days straight and, you know, what am I doing? ? You know, the one thing that I know is Reiki and my relationship to Reiki and my practice of Reiki and my ability to teach as a Reiki master. You know, those are things I know amidst all the chaos of the world, and all the questions and all the interpersonal relationships and people, you know, doing all their processing of great and small. It's what I know. And that's what I'm coming back to, simplifying. And that's what I've come to the conclusion that I know.
Hmm.
Simply. And I know that I can be of service there.
Uh-huh. And that's really beautiful. I think this is a good place to stop.
Great, Phyllis.
Thank you so much. It's been a great conversation.
Yeah, it's been great. Thank you so much for inviting me. I really had is enjoy an enjoyable hour.
Thank you. Thank you very much. This is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki, Balancing Form and Essence.